I love making money for other people. That was acquired by Activision Blizzard, and it became essentially the Call of Duty backbone. And that company last year celebrated 20 years because they sent me a nice poster.
What did it feel like?
I was like, what's next?
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Dylan Collins, the founder of companies such as Demonware and Super Awesome. There are no words to describe how good this episode is going to be. It's no false modesty. Dylan is one of the finest business thinkers I've ever had on this podcast. So sit back and relax and listen to our longest ever conversation.
Digitalization. What exactly is it and how can it transform your business? Well, the local enterprise office have you covered. Digitalization is incorporating digital tools into your business to improve efficiency and productivity, saving you time, money, and energy. It could be anything, from stock control to an online payments or booking system, and now there's a grant for it all. The Grow Digital Voucher helps businesses go digital and pay for those improvements that will make a big difference to the way your business operates. And the best thing about it all, the local enterprise office can handle it all for you. Any business from any sector with up to 50 employees can apply for the Digital for Business audit, and from there, they will give you a bespoke digital roadmap for your business. Once that's sorted, you can apply for the Grow Digital Voucher to help pay for those changes. Simple as that. So, if you want to make those first digital steps with your business to help save you time, money, and energy, talk to your local enterprise office today or go to localenterpriseoffice.ie/digital to find out more or click the link in the description below. Now, on with today's episode.
Dylan, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary.
A genuine privilege to have you here. One of the OGs of the Irish startup scene.
Oh, OGs, like triple OG. Yeah, I guess this is cool. It also makes me feel super old. but hey, look, I was, you know, it's an incredible archive that you've got here. Like,
thank you.
Like, yeah. The history that you have captured is amazing.
I get such a buzz off it because I think of it in the same way. It's like a snapshot of the person in that time, but we're catching up on all the history that they've got. But then everyone goes on to do way more. And now I'm 5 years in now. So now I'm in that lovely position of being able to go back to talk to people. Mm. And I'll just do that forever. Like, it's amazing every 5 years, every couple of years to be able to go back and go, what's been happening since? Because some companies go on a great growth trajectory, some don't.
Yeah.
But the founder story are just fascinating to me.
I just want to have this on like sort of shuffle. But like each day I'm just getting a different bit of like, you know, Irish business history.
I love it.
Irish founder history. It's very cool. It's very cool.
Yeah, well, look out for the book. Come to all bookshelves soon, right?
I hear about that.
Yeah. You were nudging me forward, which is I just need to get off and get it done. You can overthink everything, right? So give me a brief context of, I don't even know where to start with you, to be honest. I was like doing my research. I was like, I'm not even sure where to begin. Where would you like to begin?
Where would I like to begin? Oh, I mean, I suppose I've led a few lives.
Yeah, a rich life.
Both.
Best kind.
I've been fortunate to work on some amazing things and with some incredible people. So it's been a very cool journey. I suppose, I think most people always start with the Demonware kind of origin story, like in Dublin. I mean, I think that's been told. I mean, Sean Blanchfield has talked about that recently. I think Ronan Percival mentioned it when he interviewed him as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we can talk about that a little bit. But, I mean, I suppose...
Was that the start for you? Was that the first, like, founder journey, I suppose?
Well, it technically starts before that. And, I mean, again, like, you know, if anyone listening or watching this, you should just go and listen to Ronan's excellent interview where he talks about sort of him and Sean Blanchfield and me sort of meeting up in college and sort of starting our very first company, which was in the sort of a text messaging platform. This was like in the late 90s.
When text was new and cool and
so
exciting.
So for anyone sort of scrunching up their face right now to go, why are you talking about text messaging?
What's a text message? Like, mean WhatsApp? No, before that. Yeah,
there was a time pre-smartphone where that was the dominant method of communication and... We built a platform whilst we were still in Trinity College to make it easier for companies to send out messages to people's phones. And there was also kind of pre-data privacy era as well. So that's where we started. And it was kind of meeting like-minded people when we were in college together.
Did you want to be a founder? Did you like think, when I leave college, I want to be a founder? Or what were you thinking?
No, but I think we were in university, like late 90s, early 2000s. Like we all kind of graduated around 02, 03, I think. And it was kind of coming out of that first internet bubble. And so we had sort of been inspired by hearing about all these internet companies. And that really had been sort of quite effective, I think, in opening our eyes to, people can just go and build stuff. And I know to sort of, anyone probably under the age of 40 today who's listening to this is like, well, okay, that's kind of obvious. And you listen to, a lot of podcasts or read blogs or whatever, and that seems to be sort of a very obvious thing to go and do. But back then it was less so, certainly in the technology space. So I think we were just surrounded by stories of people doing things with technology with digital media, and to us it felt totally native because we were sort of that first generation growing
okay,
up.
Okay, to you it was obvious. Okay.
It really was, and every day, like I think Ronan and I would sit down and we would look at like what telecoms company in Europe was rolling out what digital strategy, and we would come up with 5 ways that they were doing it wrong and 10 ways they could do it better. And it was just absolutely sort of natural for us. So I think we were always looking for a thing. And there was a kind of a chemistry between us in terms of like thinking that way. Sean was PhD in computer science. Ronan studied law. I did business and politics. So we were coming from sort of different places, but we were just excited about building. We had, literally nothing to lose economically. And the text messaging thing ultimately then sort of split in two. One part of it became Forest, which Ronan has built very successfully. The other became Demonware, which was the
Very different paths.
Very different paths.
Which is interesting, though, because this is why I love doing this podcast. Like, because people always ask me when I meet them, they're like, "What have they all got in common? What's the success formula?" And I've kind of like moved into this thing called the founder formula, which I'm showing people now.
Sounds like a good book title.
There you go, right? I'm seeding it, right? Yeah. Just throwing it out to just see what nibbles, right? The founder formula. And my whole point is I am asking everyone on the new series, including you, like, what's your founder formula for success? Because I want people to see a list of 100. And they'll all be different. Mm-hmm. There's key characteristics. This as an investor and a founder, like, there's fundamentals, right? You just can't build without it. But everyone has a different route. Mm. Even you guys were so close, shared the same ideas. You went in completely different directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know. I spend a bunch of time reading psychology and thinking about how people's brains work. I mean, I think, myself and all the various co-founders I've worked with over the years, like, we've kind of had the attitude of, like, I suppose, sequential building, serial building. Ronan, I remember this is funny, this is turning into an interview about Ronan, which is great. But he, like, I remember Ronan saying to me, like, very early on, it's like, I just want to see what would happen if I just built one company basically forever. And he said this to me literally decades ago.
Really?
And he's done it. Like, I've the great privilege of still being like close with him and close to Sean, and we talk a lot, and we compare notes over the years. And it's one of those, it's kind of a lot of things you don't realize until you get older and you start to appreciate it. But
the dots connect in reverse, yeah.
It is, but it's also like the having had the good fortune to be able to go on like similar but different paths with people who you're still close to, like, and again, you know this, it's like building companies is a pretty lonely business, and you generally sort of get less close to people rather than more,
which is so weird. It doesn't make sense, but human psychology behind it all is amazing.
Oh, for sure. Like, and it's to some degree it's building companies becomes the identity, and you it sort of subsumes the ego, etc. But I think that the unusual kind of genesis that we had, where we're still like, we still have a thing, like, and we're able to catch up and compare things. It's pretty amazing to be able to do. But so I don't know why we, like, as in you go back further at a psychological level, why we took those pads particularly. But like, I think all of us and all founders have a certain grit, well, the successful ones at least, a determination, sort of, a willingness to just not die, refusal to die, like
survive to thrive. It's one of the things I say all the time in the pod. Just survive first, and then you can figure it all out later.
Like, a surprising amount of it comes down to that. If you can stay in the game and you've got something that is halfway viable, like, you will beat probably the majority of other people who will show up but don't keep showing up. And it's
your time will come. How many stories have we heard, Dylan, whereby, oh, we're at it for like 5-10 years, and then boom, this happened. You know, this external force you could never in a million years predict. Not in a million years. COVID is a perfect example. It's a horrible example, but it's a perfect example. Mm. How many companies have you seen where you're like, oh, we're working on this technology for ages, and then boom, Zoom.
Yeah.
Like, you know, all these companies were kind of bubbling away, doing okay, but then that just transformed us. Or we got this supplier contract from this random thing, and then overnight, our business changed.
Yeah.
Because you're there. Yeah. You've done the reps. You've built the systems. You're in the position to get lucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it's waiting, it's not dying. It's also trying to be successful and actually be semi-competent at a bunch of stuff as well. And there's like, how do you manufacture serendipity and like things like that along the way? But yes, absolutely. You know, the minimum viable requirement for founders is to just figure out how to be able to survive and be willing to make the decisions that lead to survival. You know, and they can be very, very tough. I mean, I think it helps if you are able to pick, you know, an industry that has some good dynamics. You know, I think, you know, I've been in tough industries and I've seen incredibly talented founders and management teams, you know, just battle against really, really tough industries.
And raging against the dying of the light.
Yeah, I mean, raging against the dying of your unit economics, but like, it's, you know, I mean, I like our last company, Super Awesome, you know, we spent a lot of time in the advertising space, you know, and that is just some pretty brutal, you know, unit economics about it. And, you know, it that can really make things hard. And I think the more of companies and company building and sort of occasional investing that I see and do, like, the more I really think about, like, okay, what is this industry doing? Like, can it grow? Is it going to grow? What are the underlying unit economics? I mean, you look at the world of, like, you know, last mile food delivery, for example, right? Like, and you look at sort of the sheer quantity of capital that went in there, like, over the last decade.
It still continues to do. And you're like, I think we've figured this one out now.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay, now everyone's finally making operating margins, but most of that's coming from advertising networks that they've built on top of it, right? Which is,
bizarre.
I
mean,
irony upon irony. But like, you know, I think you've got to try and be mindful about that. And like, how can you sort of stack the probabilities in your favor when you're starting? Now, like, you know, I'm whatever, 3-4 companies deep at this point. It's very easy for me to talk about this stuff. Like, when we were starting, we paid this no mind whatsoever. And sometimes, like, there is an interesting argument about, do you pick growth versus unit economics? And all the delivery investors would say, well, yes, absolutely. Or at least all the ones who made money would say yes. All the ones who lost money would say absolutely no way.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's, but I do think, I mean, it's what I spend a lot of time looking for now. Like, you know, as we sort of come out of this last big kind of 10-year wave of growth in technology and media, which was sort of driven by zero interest rates and things like that. And now you've got AI coming in, which is kind of threatening to flatten everything. Like, where are the big growth vectors, like, for the next sort of decade, 2 decades?
So tell us, where are they?
Where are they?
That's what people are here for.
I mean, I think it's, I think AI is clouding everything, and I do my best to try and ask questions about AI and listen rather than opine on it, because I think everyone's got some very fluffy comments.
I'm the exact same. I can't figure it out. It's going to be transformational, but I think there's so It's like everything, right? It's like every wave. It attracts the bullshit artists, the scammers, the grifters, the startup wannabes, the cloud, everything.
Yeah.
And I can't, I'm trying to like peer through the mire, trying to find what it is. What are your thoughts? Like, I know you don't want to opine too much on it, but go back to the waves. You talk about AI is going to be more waves. What else coming
well,
with it?
Well, let's ignore AI for a minute and come back to it. But like, I think one of the areas I'm spending a bit of time looking at is old people. And, you know, when you look at sort of digital security and cybersecurity, whatever you want to call it, around old people, like if you look at, I've been looking into some fraud data in terms of like what's going on with cyber fraud generally across all the age demographics. And I mean, unsurprising to literally anyone who's listening, like it is just rising and rising and rising, but it's probably just beginning. And when you sort of see, you know, sort of what AI is doing in terms of the ability to sort of replicate and recreate voices, like I think there's some very interesting opportunities to build necessary tools and protections for older people who are interacting with just about anything that's got an internet connection. Although it's kind of, I was looking at the report that came out of the US, and interestingly, the two biggest age brackets where you're seeing fraud and identity theft was in 60 to 69 and 30 to 39. So it's...
What's the correlation? Is there a correlation?
I don't think there's a correlation. I just think that we're starting to see, you know, different waves of sort of attack vectors and different waves of like digital naivety. And I haven't pieced it together yet. This is me, like, as I'm doing my kind of Gandalfian wandering around what I'm going to do next. But I think, like, again, just taking this back to sort of a growth point, like, it's the kind of characteristics I look for. Like, okay, is this a market that is capable of like, you know, tripling and tripling and tripling and doubling and doubling, you know, over the next 5 years? Like, can it grow by 500% in sort of 5 to 10 years? And it's quite hard, understandably, to find markets like that. I mean, I think when we started, just to jump around a bit, when we started Demonware, you know, that was when multiplayer gaming on console was just beginning. Like, that ended up going on fundamentally, I suppose, a 20-year tear.
And you could never have predicted that, right?
Well,
maybe you could. Maybe you did.
To some degree, we did, right? We were building the technology to enable it. I mean, I think, I like, you know, I think probably looking back, we sold Demonware too early. But the, and when you look at sort of, you know, Super Awesome, it was built around the fact that, you know, kids were clearly going to become a much, much, much greater part of the internet in terms of usage, you know, which they did over the course of 10 years. But now you sort of, you kind of look at what's going on in a lot of those spaces, and, you know, growth, revenue growth, whatever, kind of drops from sort of, you know, 20% per year to maybe 5, 6, 7, 8% a year. I mean, the video game space is now the biggest entertainment sector in the world, has been for years, but its growth this year might be 4 or 5%. Like, it's flat, it's mature. Okay, where are the next growth spaces going to come out of? You know, so I think those are sort of things that I mull. And I think what's like there's a huge bias, or a lot of bias, I think, around where founders choose to build, because it's kind of relevant to themselves. And that was one of the reasons that you didn't get a lot of solutions for kids being built, because most founders are not 11. And then I think the same bias is leading to sort of a lack of investment into what's needed by, you know, people above 60, 65.
I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah, we scratch our own itch, and it makes sense because we know that's a problem. That's a problem for me. Even if it's a problem for 10% of people, we're off to the races here. Mm-hmm. I think there is like going to be a gap now between like not being able to understand those problems. Like, everyone's getting older.
Yeah.
Living for longer. That is huge knock-on effects on the economy in terms of like housing, and healthcare is a huge one. Like, that is going to be astronomical.
Yep.
Nursing homes is a huge one. Yeah. Assisted living, care, all that kind of stuff. The nursing is going to become one of the biggest professions in the world.
Yeah.
Like, AI is great, but it clouds so much. It's really interesting to hear you say that, because it's now skewing everything, everyone's solution to every problem. To the man with the hammer, everything is a nail. To the man with the laptop, everything is AI. It's just, and you're kind of going, oh, lads, don't do it. Like, don't put .ai at the end of your company and think that that's the answer. Because we've been here. We've seen how many hype cycles. And the hype cycles used to be like 5 years. Now they're like 18 months. Like you'd web four, web three, web three, was it?
Three.
That's going well. You know,
look, yeah, there's cycles and all these things for sure. I mean, I think that you know, it's, I think this AI wave is, and I mean, I do not speak as an expert in this. I have an interest, but it is only semi-informed. But I think one of my observations is that it's unusual, I think, for like this early in a technology cycle to have it so dominated by the incumbents already.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I was in a conversation with someone last week where they were, you know, discussing whether they should invest into the OpenAI investment round. And the argument was like, well, you could do that, or you could just buy some more Microsoft stock. You know, and I mean, most of the foundational models at this point, like
inside, yeah,
you can just buy exposure to by buying into Amazon or Meta or Microsoft, Google, obviously. And I think that's kind of unusual.
Like, it actually is, yeah, when you think about it. Usually there's great disruptors.
There are, and they're private and they're coming through. And I mean, there's obviously a couple of those, no doubt. But like at a foundational level, if you think about like where the huge, huge wealth is potentially going to be created, like I think a lot of that is already locked up and it's sort of being baked into share prices. And I think the capital requirement now to get into that is so enormous that it's going to be very difficult, I think, for people to break into it. And I what does that mean? I don't know. I still think, you know, I mean, I see not hundreds, but certainly tens of sort of AI pitches a week from companies that are sort of trying to augment existing solutions or do whatever. But like, I would say the vast majority of those are probably just going to get crushed by the existing distribution that companies like Adobe and Salesforce and everyone has. Like,
I feel a lot of them are building features, not products. I feel some of them are building a little thing that makes your life a little bit better. But exactly what you said there, the big ones can just turn it on at a click. How many AI startups have you seen crushed by OpenAI? Here's a new update. And they're like, that was our whole business model. And that's just like line 10 of their update.
No, I think it's very tough, and I think it's like again, I'm a bit weird as a startup person or whatever you want to call me, in that like I like to generate money for investors, and I'm always looking for where the exits are. And I get into a lot of arguments with VCs about this historically, where they're like, don't worry about that, it'll take care of itself.
But VCs?
Oh, yeah.
Surely that's their whole job.
Well, it is, but they only started realizing it when interest rates began to go up. And it was harder and harder to raise the next fund. But I think on the AI side of things, like an awful lot of money is going in, and it's like, okay, what is the series of events that's going to return this capital? That's going to like grow that by 20 or 30% IRR a year, which is what VCs are meant to be delivering. Like, you've got to believe in a whole sequence of semi-miraculous things. I'm not saying people won't make money out of it. I mean, again, if you hold all those public companies or if you hold Nvidia stock, you already have. But they may well be the best ways of doing it. So I think it just creates a very murky environment. You're right. And I think like, so much of it is our little bubble of like tech and media, to your point on Man with a Hammer. Like, you know, there's still a lot of physical stuff, a lot of physical things that are huge problems. I mean, you talk about demographics. Like, I want to know where the next generation of plumbers are going to come from. Like, we still live in houses.
You've hit a sore point.
Oh, really?
I am hunting for a plumber for 3 months.
Do you know how many conversations about plumbers I've had with people in different parts of the world? Like, there is a plumber bottleneck that's happening. Like, people talk about GPUs, but honestly, plumbers are going to be more of a commodity than GPUs in 2 years' time. Mark my words.
I have a business ideas database I put down, and one of them was called Sparks, and it was just training electricians and bringing them on an apprenticeship scheme and getting them to commit to you for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then the same thing for plumbers.
I will.
I didn't have a catchy name for the plumbing one. We'll come up with, you've got good, super awesome. We'll come up with something similar, right?
I will partner with you on this because
my background is property management. I had a property management company for like 8-9 years and my heart was broken. Like, and when I found a good one, I was just like, cuddling them.
Yeah.
Like, I'll look after you. Yeah, stay with me. At the minute at home, can I get someone? I can.
Yeah.
I literally had a guy come out. And I always try to go rock for recommendations. That's just how I run everything. Got a guy recommendation. He came out and he was there a good 3.5 hours. Nice guy. Chatting away to him for 3.5 hours. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders. He goes, right, I have to head off there now. I was like, all right, is it fixed? He goes, no, Charles, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, shit. We'd know what water, no heat. I was like, right, you come back in the morning? He goes, no, I'll be back next Thursday. This was Thursday. I was like, oh, 7 days, right. So how are we going to get the old hot water working? He goes, yeah, it's a tricky one. Yeah. That was his answer.
Yeah.
Honest to God, I was just baffled.
Yeah. So no, like, I mean, look, if you were going to make some sort of long duration investments, like 20, 30 year horizons, like betting on a lot of those sort of like physical service layers, I think would make a lot of sense. Because I mean, you've got demographics are in your favor, right? There's less and less young people that are going to be around to an older population who are going to be living longer, who are, unless some sort of singularity actually happens, are going to be physical and living in houses and apartments and everything else. And, you know, we're going to need more of this, not less. And we kind of, I think there's been a complete over-rotation into AI, well, into technology in general.
Yeah.
You know, and you like, I don't know whether it's kind of monopolizing more of the general startup talent, but like,
I think so. I think these things will try to attract people, kind of are drawn to the bright, shiny thing, especially founders. We are, our focus levels are
for sure
questionable at best, right? The sweaty startup, right? That's, there's great, great. Cody Sanchez in the States has a lot of great content on this. And she has an incredible point. Like, and you flip your point the other way. You're saying like the older generation going to need it, the younger generation need it.
Mm.
Like, I would do a good bit of work on our house at home, and people go, "Oh, you're very handy." I'm like, "No, I'm not at all. I just try. I will just give it a crack." I went and did a DIY course in Cabinteely Community College over 10 weeks. Every Wednesday for 3 hours, and he just taught you the basics: plumbing, wiring, block wall, plastering. You know, basics that we all should know.
Yeah,
but no one knows.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like, your house is your biggest ever investment, mostly for most people.
Yeah.
And we're walking around like, we bought our house 5 years ago. We got an email with who the bins are provided by, what broadband they had, and that was it. They don't even come with user manuals. Like,
You
buy something 30 quid and there's like this endless documentation that comes with you accordion it out. Like, there's so many big problems yet to be solved. We live in a dumb world. So much stuff we have is dumb. Like, we talk about the Internet of Things, we talk about AI. There's so much disconnect between the actual real world. Why is it, fact or fiction, is there less wow moments in technology now than there used to be, or is our bias taking over? So like the first iPhone, things like that that genuinely surged things forward. People would lean over in a pub going, "What is that?" I can't remember the last time I saw something or bought something that I was like, this changes everything. Is that bias or is that fact?
I don't know. I mean, it's certainly subjective, but like, it's, you know, I think everyone is sort of fully immersed in, you know, content and real-time content and access to absolutely everything. So I think it certainly takes proportionately more. I think that's why money keeps going into VR, you know, because, and now glasses with what Meta's unveiled with Orion, like, you know, because it is a sufficient kind of step change in experience. And I think when you put on any sort of VR headset, it's kind of like, holy shit, like this is cool and different. But yeah, I think we're, you know, we are getting desensitized to lots and lots of things, you know, and to your earlier point, like, you know, everyone's kind of, I don't know if they're getting more specialized in areas, but they're certainly abstracting away more of their lives, you know, which is interesting. People pitch a lot of use cases to me around AI and sort of like, well, you know, I use it to sort of construct an argument or to do, you know, to try and do some reasoning for me. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. And I see the productivity, but also I don't know if I want to outsource my reasoning capability.
I'm just going to take the words of your thinking. Outsource your brain. I use AI and I use Notion, and the two of them together are like a second brain for me.
Yeah, yeah.
It shouldn't be my brain. Mm-hmm. If you take away humans' ability to reason and humans' ability to think logically.
No, I mean, look, there's no... I think with every technology wave, I mean, I end up still kind of getting drawn into conversations about, like, you know, technology and kids and the impact of social and internet and smartphones, you know, on sort of kids and teens. And it, like, every wave of technology brings pros and cons. Mm. Like, it's not, you know, it is like nothing is completely better. It always, there is always a trade-off, right? And things just change, you know, and you look at the history of like, you know, our species. And, you know, it has risen and fallen and like, you know, we advance things or we take a few steps back. And that has just historically always been true. It's one of the very few consistent things you can say. Mm. I think, you know, when you look about sort of the rush into AI, like, you know, it's still kind of wild that you have a lot of people sort of declaring that sort of, okay, well, we're trying to build AGI because that's going to go and basically do everything for us. And then that deflates the economy and universal basic income and then we have nothing. And it's kind of like, okay, so we're all basically talking about some giant sort of digital death cult that we're all subscribing to and investing tens of billions of dollars in.
I can't get the logic.
It's fascinating. And to some degree, like, you know, well, to a very large degree, people don't know exactly where this is going. Like, are there enormous benefits that will come out of what's now being built around LLMs? Yeah, I'm sure lots, right? And maybe even some productivity too. Who knows? But it isn't unusual in the history of things for people to just be sort of barreling towards the unknown with sort of like, you know, more technology is a goal, right?
It's funny you said that. In my head, I had this thing like hurtling towards it. Mm. It feels like we're just on this massive rocket ship towards it. And everyone's really, really excited, but they can't really tell you why. And they can't really tell you what's actually going to happen. Mm. Oh, it's going to be class. Okay. Mm. How specifically? Oh, like it's going to do all the shit work you don't want to do. Okay. But like, there's loads of shit work I have to do. I still have to cut my garden. I still have to, like, now you can get robo mowers, I know. But like, yeah, I just can't fully square that circle. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about technology and kids, but I also want to go back to a couple of we got drawn into AI.
It's so easy to do. I wish people would invest more money into, thinking about demographics and fertility rates, because that's an issue. And I wish more people, or there would be more capital invested into research into the sun and more capital invested into near Earth object identification, because it would be an awful shame to develop some kind of API for an asteroid to wipe out the planet. And I don't know, it feels like we could just allocate a little bit to that.
What waves, right? So we're going to sidestep AI. What other waves? You said two, their demographic and fertility rates. Actually, we had Philip McGlade from Therapy Fertility and just literally before you, and he was talking about that, like how it's a massive, massive issue, like globally. Mm. Fertility rates are dropping astronomically. Huge environmental factors contributing to it. What are you thinking in that space?
I'm not a scientist. I just sort of look at the numbers. I mean, I think it's, you know, you look at the implications for demographics over the next 50 to 100 years, And like in the West, it's pretty frightening. You know, one in terms of the proportion of younger working people whose tax base is going to be required to support all the older people. I mean, there is the mother of all battles coming up between old and young, like, which is sort of going to be very interesting. You know, secondly, like for countries like China, I mean, within the next 100 years, on the current trajectory, China loses 50% of its population.
I was reading that last week, the Financial Times, in a brilliant, like, in-depth piece on it. I was like, whoa. And they were they actually went back 25, 30 years, 40 years, the single child policy, and how that now is playing out.
Well, it's in contrast, you got the US, right, which went through the baby boom, and they're one of the few countries in the West, actually, who will have a larger population for longer, just because they've had more kids. They've had historically a slightly higher fertility rate. I mean, it has all sorts of interesting impacts. But like one of the things that I sort of poke at a little bit is like, how does this break our investing assumptions about the future, right? So we tell people now to go and like, you know, when they're thinking about their pension, it's like, well, you know, you should go and invest in the market because this is the return it's going to give you. But like that return is sort of based on, well, very much based on historic performance. But all of that, like, you know, certainly in the US market and in other markets, like, was predicated on population growth at a certain level. Like, if you look at when Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett started investing together, which was roughly from the late 60s, like, the US population over in the 50-year span since that, like, the US population doubled. Right. So they had, you know, you could make a bunch of investments and you could do absolutely nothing. And on the basis of there being more people to consume more stuff, your investment was going to go up. Now, if you look at the US today and you go forward 50 years, there's still growth there in terms of population, but it's only half that.
Okay.
And like that is a very, very different picture, obviously. And like that's the best case. Most of the other countries are far, far less than that. So I think
is this skewing how you think about investing?
It's making me think about like what, you know, like if these are the long-term trends and that is the math, at what point do these things start to get pulled forward in terms of how people are thinking about them? Right. Like if my assumption is that, like, you know, I can generate sort of, I don't know, whatever, 7, 8, 9, 10% a year from the S&P, like, because that has been true for the last 40 years. It's like, okay, that's probably going to come down a lot, like over the next sort of 10, 20, 30. I mean, this is probably a conversation for Stephen Kinsella or Ronan Lyons to get involved with, but it does feel like the future, the nearish future, is going to diverge from what the historical norms have been over the last 30, 40, 50 years. And I don't really know what the consequences of that are. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to poke around and figure out, like, you know, where is there going to be, you know, something that is kind of seismic, I mean, either good or bad, and then sort of figure out where are the businesses that can be built around that.
It's the Munger thing, show me where I'll die so I'll never go there.
Absolutely.
He's just a quote machine, right?
I mean, he's the master of inversion, right?
Yeah, exactly. So let's pull some signal from the noise then. This is your Gandalf moment, like you've been wandering and figuring all the stuff out for me. So we have loads of aspiring founders listening. What areas should they be doing deep dives into?
Where to build businesses? I hate asking or answering that question. I mean, look, I think I will give you a collection of probably not connected answers. I mean, I've spent a bunch of time looking at the UGC gaming space, so user-generated content gaming space. So around Fortnite, Roblox, Discord, you're seeing like lots of interesting companies be built from people who are just starting with games or communities in those places. And what's really interesting about those, at least in my opinion, is that they're companies that are being built in a sort of a non-startup ecosystem. Like when you go, because I spend a lot of time with these founders, and like they're all young, like 19, 20, 21, 22, like they've never heard of Y Combinator and they don't give a shit about it.
Probably a good thing.
because they're making all their money from Roblox, or they're making all their money from Fortnite and UEFN. And like, I think those places are like, when you're interviewing in, let's say, 10 years time, right? Like that cohort of, let's say, Irish founders who've come through, I guarantee you some percentage of them will have started their first company, not as a text messaging platform, but as a game or a map or something that they built in UEFN or Roblox. Like, and I'm also reasonably convinced that, like, you know, at least $1 billion plus company is going to come out of those ecosystems, because they are being built as places for developers to go and build and play and monetize. And, you know, they're interesting for a couple of reasons, I think. You know, one is because they are, to some degree, they have kind of been hijacked as originally gaming places, which are now turning into social places. Right.
Interesting.
So they are, like, when you think about sort of, you know, the last way, the last sort of collection of sort of social channels, right? It was Facebook, and it's Insta, and it's WhatsApp, and it's sort of text messaging, right? Like, now it is, you know, Telegram and Fortnite and Roblox and Discord. Like, it's a whole new cluster. But they're not apples to apples. Like, they are very different things in terms of how they're being used. So I think that's interesting. I think the second interesting thing is, like, that first wave of sort of social platforms, to a large degree, was sort of social functionality being built on an advertising engine, right? These, because the majority of these new platforms originated as sort of gaming platforms, they are being built on kind of a transactional basis. So they're not being built as advertising first.
Yeah, which I think is good.
I have a complicated relationship with advertising, in that, like, we've built quite successful businesses around it, but I also believe that the attention economy has probably destroyed the internet. And if I could go back in time and change one thing, it would probably be that. So yes, I do kind of agree about that. I think advertising is a terrible business model for content consumption for humanity.
It's your incentives. Again, God, it's like a Munger fan club, but, like, show me your incentives, I'll show you your outcome.
Absolutely.
It's true. Like, across, and like you, I read a lot of psychology, mainly to understand my own brain, which then helps me understand others, because if you don't understand yourself, you're never going to understand anyone else. It's true, though. What you're incentivized by will determine how you act, both in the short term and the long term. Mm-hmm. If you seek short-term monetary gain, people tend to take shortcuts sometimes, which doesn't necessarily have the best overall outcome for humanity.
Yeah. I think that's totally true. I mean, it's why I'm actually, like, I'm very pleased to see the rise of, you know, newsletter commerce, you know, and I think, like, I pay for a bunch of newsletters. I'm sure you do. I'm sure everyone listening does, right? And it's cool.
Like, what are your favorites? Give us some recommendations.
I have to pull out my phone. But, like, I subscribe to, like, some ancient history. I mean, the thing is, like, you
let your nerd out. It's fine.
Business, you're hoping for a business answer, and it's like, dude,
no, I'm not.
You, like, restaurant, like,
I'm genuine. No, because this is the complexity, right? I actually think we can get too obsessed by these things. We can get too obsessed by reading, consuming content all the time. It's funny. People always ask me, well, like, what other podcasts do you listen to? And I'm like,
I'll give you a list, but
generally, like, random stuff, like some history, but, like, sport. I like to tune out. I'll listen to, like, Man United podcast of, like, 59 minutes about why they got absolutely walloped this week again. I consume a eclectic mix.
Yeah.
Like, I will read all, like, this morning I was reading a parenting book. Like, I think the most interesting people I know are interested. Be interesting and be interested. That's how I think about it, like, myself. Like, be interested in others and be an interesting person. And you do that by having breath.
Yeah. Look, I think each their own. I just try and be interested in other people as much as I can. I mean, like, I subscribe to, like, for food writing, Victuals, you know, which is Jonathan Nunn, who's a London-based, excellent London-based food writer. For history, I subscribe to Razib Khan. I just signed up to Taylor Lorenz's new. So Taylor Lorenz.
Lorenz.
She's a very interesting reporter, mostly on sort of the creator economy.
What's the new? Do you know what the newsletter is called?
I've forgotten.
Taylor. You'll
search.
I'll find it. Okay.
You'll find it. I subscribe. I mean, well, the currency isn't newsletter, but I also subscribe to that. I sort of almost categorize it sort of within that. There's a rap newsletter I subscribe to.
A what now?
A rap. Sort of a hip. Well, it's more sort of a Patreon.
You are eclectic character. Rap.
Well, I started by, a lot of people joke that so much of what I do is because I was a terrible rap DJ and sort of that career didn't go anywhere.
Oh, now we're getting into it. Yeah. Now we're going somewhere fun. Yeah. Rap.
I used to be a hip hop DJ. Like, I mean, back when pirate radio was a thing, I played on pirate stations in Dublin.
Did you have a name?
Yes.
Going to tell us?
No. You can Google and you can probably find it. Actually, I don't know. I haven't tried that, so I'm not sure.
Rapidly sweating, checking Google to see if people are finding us.
No. I mean, hip hop and rap is my thing. I absolutely love it. Like, really? It's.
I think there'd be a lot of people listening who would have known that about you. So there you go.
I don't know. I think anyone who's worked with me knows it, because all of our project, when we're looking at like investments or acquisitions or doing anything, I always insist on code names. Because it's important and people like leak information accidentally. But you will always know a project I'm involved with because it will have like a rap album name as its code name.
Give me some of the ones that are expired. You don't have to give us current top secret.
Well, you won't know what they are. But I mean, there was a very big project like in Epic Games at one point that was called Project Illmatic, for example.
Illmatic.
Yeah, it's the first Nas album.
Okay. I love this. Now we're really getting.
Well, I wanted to call something like I wanted to reference Scary Era in a code name, but no one could pronounce it because I was dealing with too many Americans. Scary Era was one of the classic Irish rap groups, Re-Raw and DJ Mech. They were assigned to Island Records, I think, in the 90s. You should look them up. They're very good.
I love that. They're the little things that make life fun, right?
Oh,
having a
dude,
bit
for sure.
of crack in your day to day going. Yeah, we're going to have like code names and it's going to be like about rap albums.
Well, it's always amazing when people ask us, so where did this code name come from? And you just sort of describe it and just the room goes quiet because no one really knows what to say. Particularly in some of the circles I move that are, I don't know, a little bit more polished than me, perhaps.
So bring me back to your own journey, right? Because I think people will be familiar with Demonware. You built that up and then you sold. You said earlier you kind of referenced maybe selling too early, but what was the process around selling that? Because I'm interested to get your ideas and your insights around kind of like founder selling companies.
Oh, I have lots of thoughts on that. I suppose, let me just take a run through all of them so you've got the context. But like, that was acquired by Activision Blizzard, and it became essentially the Call of Duty backbone.
Amazing.
And that company last year celebrated 20 years because they sent me a nice poster. It was just amazing that...
Just a poster?
Yeah.
Nothing else?
Well, they sent me something earlier on as well. But
a Lamborghini.
It was kind of amazing that, like, you know, for a software company to be in business for 20 years and also like for an acquired business to be around for 20 years is absolutely remarkable.
Call of Duty, though, is an epic franchise. I'm a Call of Duty gamer. I love it.
And then Warzone and everything else. Yeah, no, the team...
Warzone's my switch off. That's how I switch off.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
how I... If
I'm, I mean, I'm still more Fortnite for kind of obvious reasons. But yeah, John Kirk and the team did absolutely amazing work growing and building that in Activision, and it was a great example of an excellent acquisition where they invested in it and you know it really added a tremendous amount of value. And two separate former Activision CFOs have told me the internal valuation of it and laughed at what we sold it for versus what they now value it at. Oh, like, okay.
Context is everything, though. At the time, I'm sure that was all the money in the world to you.
Oh, for sure. But it's an interesting, you know, like, I think when it comes to sort of selling companies or being acquired, like, there are so many considerations that go into it. And I am a believer in sort of like, you know, pricing maximums where you, or local maximums in pricing, right? Where you can, you know.
What does that mean?
As in, like, you know, sometimes you will be in a little micro bubble within a bubble. you know, and people are overpricing things, you know, and you have to be able to have a grown up conversation with investors and say, look, we think we're being priced probably 2 or 3 years ahead of where we are right now. Like, you know, if we don't take this, we don't need to take this because our balance sheet might be good. But this probably means that we are going to be here for another 6 years or 7 years or 8 years.
Right.
And it's, you know, those are tricky conversations, you know, especially when you're, because again, you're sort of like, I always laugh when investors say, you know, kind of casually say, oh, we'll just sell this company. It's like, anyone who says that doesn't know what they're doing or hasn't done a huge amount of it, because you don't just sell a company. Like if you're in a fund and you're investing, like the duration of your fund has absolutely no bearing on the optimal time to sell that company, because that is predicated on like what's going on in the market. It's what strategics are doing, and like a timeline for a strategic buyer, like, you know, if it's a big software company, big tech company, whatever, right? Like their timeline is wholly independent and unrelated to what you're doing, right? And that, like, at some point that will be there and at some point that won't be there. And I mean, you know, you can argue around sort of the entire spectrum of this stuff, but like I am a believer in like, you know, not necessarily being able to choose the optimal time to sell. You know, sometimes you get lucky on that, and sometimes it sort of is around where, like, you know, an amount of money has gone in and it's not too much and it's not too little and it's gotten you to a certain scale, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, you know, in general, I think investors, certainly the more recent generation of venture investors, have to get much more aggressive, much more hands-on, much more creative in how they are returning capital, you know. And that means you've got to have, and I think you can have that now. Like when, you know, these days when I talk to venture investors and you're talking about exits and selling companies, you know, no one is getting weird about those words being used in a room. Whereas you go back to 2018 and 2019, you know, and you're in a room with VC and you're talking about, you know, money, and you're sort of saying, well, shall we talk about where the exit's going to come from? And they're like, oh, well, we don't really want to talk about that too much. You know, blue sky, just keep going, keep going, keep going.
Why was that? This is something I've thought about a lot. Is that because they didn't want to be seen to be too founder aggressive? Didn't want to seem to be like, oh, we're going to come in and sell this out from under you? Because I know there's a wave of that. I read The Power Law recently.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Such a good book.
Yeah, like, it's great. It's
a really good book.
One of my founder recommendations.
Yeah, really helped me kind of understand investing a lot more, especially VC investing. And there was a wave of like, you know, companies again bought, broken apart, and sold. And then there was like the reverse wave when founders were empowered, they were like empowered to go because it was kind of the hero founder era. Yeah. Was that why they were afraid to kind of like be seen as like the big bad VC wolf?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of that. And there is a, I think you got to separate out like what the companies were doing and the funds trying to convince founders to take money versus like the business of building a fund. You know, you got to bear in mind that like when you're a fund and you're investing, like to one degree or one level, you are trying to sell to founders, hey, take my money. But on the other hand, you're also trying to sell to your LPs, to your investors. It's like, hey, give me some more money. You know, so you're really trying to like serve two masters. And at some point that starts to diverge. Mm. So I think like, you know, if you want to be in the long-term business of running a fund, you have got to raise more funds because you have to increase your assets under management so that you can generate more fees, so you can do more things, et cetera, right? So you have to be able to show markups, as in like you've got to be able to show your portfolio increasing in value, which means you've got to get into the important deals, which means you've got to be nice to founders, which means you've got to make founders feel that you're non-hostile, non-threatening, you know. So I think all of that like was
did it go too far though? Did it go too fuzzy friendly? Did it go too far? And then there was like,
I don't know. It's hard to generalize. I mean, yeah, sure, at the extremes, yeah, of course, like and we work and everything else, right? But like, it's, I do think that like in general, venture capital has got not enough people who have got experience returning money to investors, not enough experience selling companies. Now, I do think that is changing. Like, and again, this is not me sort of shitting on the VC class. Like, there are some very good investors out there. Like, And but there are a lot of other investors that are not good. And that's true in any asset class, right? But I think the challenge in VC is that, like, you know, it has probably been one of the great business marketing success stories of the last 20 years, right? Like, you know, VC sort of convincing the world that it exists as a thing and that you should be part of that ecosystem. And it's sort of the startup industrial complex, right? and like, you know, if you're building a thing, like, I'm still surprised that I get conversations from founders, like younger founders today, and they're like, well, I need some money, therefore I'm going to go and talk to some VCs. And I'm like, whoa. Like, one, why do you need money? Two, like, you know, do you understand, like, the VC model? Do you understand their economics? Do you understand what their returns need to be? And I think, like, it has been, in many respects, too successful for its own good, as in the marketing of the space, because everyone thinks you need to go there and tick that box.
I was just going to say that to you. You've given me two gems there, the startup industrial complex. I'm robbing that. You'll hear that coming out of my mouth loads of times now. But then the marketing of VC, that's like a really interesting point. They became the default solution. Startups need money, VC. Startups need money, VC. Like, bootstrapping fell out of fashion. You know, angels fell out of fashion. You know, getting loans fell out of fashion. It was always the VC. So where do we sit now? Because there's been, obviously, we had the hype cycle of 2020 to 22, and then now it's been a real cooling off period. So where do we sit in 2024 with this?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I think that at a founder level, like, you know, I get into lots of conversations with founders who are starting their first thing or second thing, and their attitude is like, well, I'm going to bootstrap it, which means either I'm just going to sort of try and do this purely through revenue, or I'm only going to take one check, one round, and I'm not sort of planning on making this sort of a daisy chain of financings in terms of, like, you know, pre-seed, seed, series A, et cetera, et cetera. And that's kind of their attitude. I wouldn't say it's like an anti-VC attitude, but, like, it's definitely being more mindful about what capital is going in. I think second, third time repeat founders, like, you know, again, generalizations, but, like, I think a lot of them get a lot more comfortable in using debt, you know, where they can. I think you're seeing a lot of people thinking about roll-ups and sort of M&A and structured stuff in terms of how to build and how to scale. And I think that's very healthy, right? Like, you know, there are lots of different ways to sort of build and construct companies. And I think having a little bit more, like, of a, I mean, I've always sort of felt myself as having kind of a private equity mindset in a VC ecosystem. And I think having a little bit more of that is probably good. Because at the end of the day, if you are taking money from people, you know, sometimes everyone forgets that you have got to return it, you know, with a kind of a commensurate kind of risk-adjusted return, right? So I think you are getting, you know, more nuances in how founders think about building. And I think on the investor side, like, you are definitely seeing, you know, some VCs start to think, you know, much more creatively about how they're scaling. So, you know, Molten Ventures actually today or yesterday just announced they'd acquired another fund. You know, they've been it's their stated strategy. They buy secondary portfolios. So they're basically buying portfolios from other VCs. You can almost kind of think of them as like a VC fund roll-up. And that's really interesting because, you know, you'll have all of these VCs and they're sitting on a portfolio of stakes and the companies aren't getting acquired, but they still have to figure out how to return money, you know, to their investors. So when you've got a player in the market who's saying, okay, well, we're going to buy your portfolio that returns money to those investors, that fund can then go and raise another fund that puts more money into the ecosystem. Like, I think that's super interesting to see. But I also think you're seeing, like, you know, a lot of, or certainly much far more, and definitely more in Europe, serial founders, repeat founders, who are putting together like SPVs and syndicates of angel investors to go and do rounds and lead rounds. I mean, this has been going on in the US obviously for years, and it's been going on in Europe for a bit, but you're seeing it, or at least I'm seeing it more and more. And, you know, in several cases, you know, you're seeing companies that are like, you know, turning down like a VC term sheet because they would prefer to take a syndicate of useful angels. So I think that there's a shortening of the distance between founders and capital that has come out from all of this, because, you know, founders are getting a bit more capital sophisticated, I would say, on average. And I think, you know, 5 years time, I would expect, you know, the VC market to probably look a lot more consolidated. And I would expect some of them to sort of look a little bit more like private equity and getting a little bit more creative in terms of what they're doing. And I would also expect there to be a lot more debt floating around. You know, I think everyone, like, you know, venture debt has been like, has quite an interesting history, you know, and, you know, we took a lot of it, or took a chunk of it, at least in Super Awesome. And it makes a lot of sense. Anyone who's an equity investor kind of doesn't like it for the obvious reasons. But I do think you're going to see more of that over time. So I think we're going to come out of this decade in general with a much healthier sort of company building, company investing ecosystem. Probably not without a bunch more pain along the way, but I think you actually end up with more kind of robust companies and probably higher quality investors. Now, I think it'll take the rest of the decade though.
So take me back then to Super Awesome. What a name. The exit Demonware.
Yep.
What happens then?
Left Demonware, or, well, left Activision.
So you were bought and then you stayed for a wee bit?
Stayed for a bit. Was very impatient. Felt a burning need to start a new thing. At the time, this was like 2007, 08, I guess. You had social gaming was starting to become a thing. So you had like Zynga and companies like that. And so I started that was the only company I started as a solo founder, games publisher called Jolt. And we licensed IP and built social games and browser games.
What does that mean for anyone not familiar? I'm sure it was like, I mean, everyone probably knows the names if you say them.
Yeah, I mean, we licensed, made games like Zork, and we made, I think, Playboy Manager and a bunch of other ones. The Playboy game was quite amusing. That led to...
I thought you said it. I was like, maybe he means Football Manager.
No, it was Playboy Manager. We licensed the IP from Playboy, which led to some very amusing conversations. And that company ended up getting acquired by GameStop, who, this was around 09?
Oh, wow.
10, because that was when GameStop, who, this was kind of pre-meme GameStop.
I watched that movie a few days ago. I was coming back in a ferry and they had it. I was like, I've been meaning to watch this for ages. It was brilliant.
It's amazing. But if you can imagine like 10 years before that, right, when they were at, like, probably peak retail.
Yeah.
So they had probably about 4,500 stores in the US. They were like, it was kind of peak like physical console gaming.
Oh, I used to love it. Going in to get the new Football Manager, or getting in to get the new like Call of Duty. Oh, it was huge.
Yeah. The have you interviewed Kevin Neary?
No.
Oh, you should interview Kevin. He ran a games retail chain in Ireland called Games World.
Oh yeah.
And he was acquired by GameStop. But interesting fact, Kevin was one of the first angel investors in Demonware and in Jolt.
Okay.
So you should talk to Kevin.
Okay. We'll set that up.
He's good. So that was when GameStop were trying to shift from, not shift, but trying to figure out like, okay, shit, we've got this amazing physical retail business. What do we do about the internet?
So let's not become Extravision.
Yeah. And so they acquired us to try and kick off that strategy. And they ended up buying four or five, six other companies. I would say in general, it was not a success because they were in that classic sort of corporate crossing the chasm challenge where they were like, you know, they felt that anything they were investing in on the digital side was cannibalizing their physical business. And at any one point, like,
right,
a huge chunk of their outstanding shares was being shorted by the market. So everyone was basically betting that the share price was going to go down, which meant that, like, you know, every quarterly earnings was just like, you know, running through a minefield.
So you sold two. Right? You sold two companies. How close to each other did you sell them?
That was probably within 3 years.
What was different the second time?
What was different?
Did you approach it differently? Or like, I'm always curious about like serial founders. I love kind of try to tease out, like, I hate asking that cliche question. If you knew now, what you knew then? Because I think it just leads to cliched answers.
I think that a thing that has emerged over time with my experiences on this, because I mean, if you look at sort of Demonware and Jolt and Super Awesome, but then also Potato, where I was chairman, sort of more executive chairman on that with the two founders. So that was a marketing services agency in London, which WPP acquired. I was sort of doing that in my spare time. but if you look at that sort of data set, like a lot of it, this is also not a surprise, comes down to relationships and chemistry. Mm. Like it's very rare, even in all the things that I've seen sort of tangentially or from a distance, like that deals get done without some kind of pre-existing chemistry between the principals. And one of the things I like when people sometimes ping me and they're at a certain stage in the company and they're like, hey, like, you know, we're thinking about maybe selling it, or we've had some inbound, or like, what do we do? And I'm like, okay, have you gone and made a list of all the people who might buy you? And they're like, well, kind of, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. Do you know like who the key people are? Do you know the CEOs in there? Have you got relationships? You founders, whoever they are, like, have you got relationships in there? Do you know them? And most of the, well, some of the time they do, some of the time they don't. But like, usually, like, I really hate giving advice because so much of this is survivorship bias. But like, one of the things that I do think is a really good investment is like, build up a relationship with all the people you think might at some point buy you. Because it matters. And like, you can have an incredible business that is phenomenally profitable, doing amazing growth, and you can hire a bank to go and sell you. And okay, that will probably work. But most companies are not going to be in that top decile or top sort of quintile of companies. Most companies are going to be good. Okay, you've got a couple of potential buyers. It's, you know, maybe you are lucky enough to have someone saying, hey, we think we might want to buy you. Like, but a lot of the time it's way messier behind the scenes and you will take, you know, multiple runs at these things. Mm. But like in all of those cases, like when we've been acquired, like it was never, there was one exception, but like it was never like someone leaning across the dinner table going, we'd like you to join the family. It was always like spending time with people and comparing notes on strategy. And then like, you know, oftentimes it's like we were going out to raise investment and we're like, hey, we're going to raise to do this. Here's okay. Our plan. You know, we've got chemistry. Like, you know, we've got some shared values. And it's usually at that point, like where something can come around. But I like investing in network and investing very specifically in potential acquirer network. And I mean, that sounds like it's a little bit like unimaginative. And often, you know, companies come out of nowhere that you hadn't thought about, but like it will usually always pay some kind of dividend.
There's very little downside, right? There's very little downside to building more quality people in your network. It's one of those bits of advice that it seems quite logical and obvious, but when you actually sit down and think about it, it's not. People won't have kind of gone, okay, who could buy us? Okay, great. Do we have any relationship with them? If they're just names on a spreadsheet,
you can, I mean, people I think make what is often the mistake of thinking they just need to know the corp dev person.
Mm.
It's like, no, in most, a lot of companies, corp dev are kind of admin. Like they're lining it up, they've got to find a champion internally to go and put some career risk on the line. Because most deals these days, like I think what a lot of people don't realize is that like a lot of acquisitions equate to career risk for someone on the acquiring side. Like people don't think like that, you know,
yeah.
and you know, I think in GameStop, you know, the it was a very different type of acquisition because they were sort of trying to bridge into the future, whereas in Activision, they already felt they were there, and it was a slight, you know, they didn't have a technology division in Activision at the time. It was all game studios. And so Demonware became sort of essentially the bedrock, the foundation of their technology business. Whereas,
well, that's a transformational acquisition.
It's transformational, but it's really sort of like, you know, it's adding on another dimension, or it's adding on another piece to a direction you were heading in. Whereas with the GameStop deal, because you were trying to do something that was a different business, and that fundamentally, like that was transformational, because you sort of long term you wanted to say, hey, we got to move all of this revenue all the way over here, and that's going to displace a whole bunch of stuff. And you were running into all sorts of like politics. You were running into sort of like
there's public vested market interests. Politics.
Oh,
there's vested in, like that's the one thing I think people forget
in a literal sense. I mean, you had their e-commerce teams that were running the website, fundamentally competing with their physical retail teams, and they couldn't discount on the website because that would undermine obviously physical retail, which meant that e-commerce couldn't be competitive with Amazon. Right. And you think about like how do you try and untangle like that sort of Gordian knot? And so, you know, like again, when we went in there, one of the things we were pitching, it's actually one of the coolest things we did, was so at the time we were doing all of our user acquisition, obviously through Facebook. So we were acquiring users and spending money. And we kind of realized, well, holy shit, like GameStop had built this amazing loyalty program. So when you went in and you sort of traded a game, you would swipe your card and it would go in. We said, well, can we connect our user acquisition system to your point of sale system? And absolutely everyone told us no. And we were like, well, how about yes? So I remember like we managed to convince their management team to let us roll out an integrated system into their point of sale across the entire North American retail chain, where whenever you would go in and buy a game, on the receipt that you would get, on the physical receipt, like it would give you a unique code which you could plug into our social games. And it reduced our user acquisition cost by 75%.
Wow.
And it was like, and it was at that point where I said, guys, you don't realize what you've got here. You are the world's biggest gaming social network. You just haven't turned it on yet.
Yeah.
And everyone
have that critical relationship with the gamer.
For sure. And it was like, and it was fucking amazing for a quarter. And then they shut the whole thing down because it was like, okay, cool. That was the initiative there. Like now we've got to go on and do other, because they were just they were competing with so many different things, right? But when you look at what GameStop is today, that's why like it's fascinating to watch everything like and Roaring Kitty and that whole thing. Like it's, you know, I was there when a bunch of us saw what it could be in the future. Like what the counterfactual was. But I mean, like the counterfactual today, the counterfactual of GameStop is that today, you know, it would be bigger than Steam, bigger than Discord. Like it would be the Western version of Tencent, right? If you look at Tencent today, right, Chinese media company, by far, I would say probably the most successful video games investor of all time. No one is probably even close. GameStop had that opportunity to be there. Like, and
it's amazing how many traditional companies had that, but couldn't, as you say, cross the chasm between the digital and the physical because that you had two different warring factions.
I still hope, that's why I'm quite a big fan of Smith's Toys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's an unbelievable business.
It's amazing.
I bring my daughter there, and mainly she's just cover. She's just cover, so I'm not wandering around on my own as a grown man in Smith's. Unbelievable.
But I think they're in a position and they've got the thinking and the sophistication where they could do something very interesting, I think, in retail and commerce and kids and family at some point in the future. But it is tough, like, you know, that kind of business transformation, which is you're just trying to do so many things. And whilst public, it's just...
What did you make of that whole Roaring Kitty, GameStop run? How did you view that as an industry insider? Because I was fascinated watching it at the time. I was doubly fascinated reliving it then through what we're watching it. And my wife turns to me and goes, why weren't you involved in this? It's the exact kind of scheme I would love to get involved in. I was deep in Bitcoin at the time.
No worry.
I had enough fires to put out, Michelle. I had enough things trying to occupy my mind.
I mean, I think we were, this was pre, when was this post? It was 2020, wasn't it?
2020, middle of pandemic. Like that's why people were glued.
We were getting acquired by Epic Games at that point. So I was kind of distracted.
Okay.
But no, lots of people pinged me and they said, do you still have your GameStop shares? I'm like, nope. But it was the games industry's general response was just sort of bemusement.
Yeah, I think that was everybody's.
Yeah, for sure, right? It was kind of like, this is just wild, you know. And I think it was kind of interesting from a capital market standpoint, which is sort of one of my other hats, like in the sense that like the sort of the power of retail. Like, and everyone laughs at retail behind the scenes, right? Like, you know, if you're selling to retail, like, you know, as a financial product or whatever, it's like, you know, what do these idiots know? But the fact that they were sort of like essentially coming together and you know, they felt they were
dumb
sort of
money
on Wall
is
Street,
such a good title.
It is, but they you know, I wouldn't, you know, don't fuck with Reddit, like, you know, and it's, I think there is still a lurk. I mean, he's obviously come back, or allegedly it was him who came back recently and traded on that, made a ton of money, and has since vanished, right? Like, I mean, Matt Levine, I don't know if you read his newsletter.
No.
Excellent.
What does he cover?
He's a Bloomberg newsletter writer.
Okay.
But he writes about sort of public markets and things like that. Okay. And he writes excellently on Elon Musk. He writes excellently on all the GameStop stuff. He has speculated about many things around there. But I think there's kind of a lurking retail power there that will get reactivated from time to time. And obviously it took a run at Web3. It's taken a run at other things. But it is interesting where it comes from. Like, I went through a spate recently, like, of being in a few Ubers, and like the drivers would turn around to me and they would ask, apropos of nothing, like, what are you investing in? I was like,
really?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, I was like, well, various things. I was like, but kind of give me some context. What are you investing in? And this was random, right? Really,
that's like, always such like alert, sell everything.
Kind of. No. But it was. But they were investing in, like, so they were telling me different coins they were investing in, and I'm like, okay, it's like there was a lot of kind of crypto stuff. But it's, and I was like, and they were like, well, what should I invest in? I said, well, why don't you just go and buy a really cost-effective index fund in the S&P, like, and they were like, "What's that?" I'm like, "Huh?"
So they were buying individual shares, were they?
They were buying coins. They were buying coins. I mean, they were buying crypto. But no, but the point was that, like, you have, you know, I used to sort of roll my eyes a little bit when people would talk about like the need for kind of financial literacy and investment literacy and things like that, and I think I was just being an idiot, like. It is amazing, like, how many people are comfortable investing, but don't sort of have the basics on sort of, you know, how some of the markets work, like how sort of index funds work. And there's pros and cons to those, and you'll hear interesting arguments around that. But like, but ultimately, I think you're getting more and more pressure, like probably post-COVID, post-Robinhood and everything else, where people are just looking for ways to make a little bit more money. Mm. And I think that's actually quite healthy. But I just wish there were more alternatives than sort of like, you know, whatever, sort of buying or selling options on GameStop or things like that. Like, I do think probably in the West, maybe everywhere, financial literacy, investment literacy is really, really bad. And TikTok is probably making it worse. So I don't know what else to think about that. And I may well be wrong. Like, you know, this is why my newsletter is called Half Formed Thoughts, not Fully Formed. It's like, I don't know, I put half of it out there and just see what I hear back, and I get smarter on that basis.
Oh, look, you and me share this. Like, I do these experiments, and I'm starting to get more, I'm willing to put myself out there a bit more. I think I've hidden behind guests a little bit too much over the years, so I'm starting to do these little experiments because that's how I believe and how I live my life. And I've started this art of compounding experiment. Mm. So during COVID, I did coffee to crypto. Every day, I'd not buy my morning coffee, which is £3, and I invest in crypto.
Oh, interesting.
End of the year, we had a couple of grand. Brilliant. Just to teach myself the power of compounding, because it's the psychology thing you talked about, Ronan, there at the start, being able to see into the future, going, I'm just going to do one company forever. Very few of us have that foresight and that patience and the ability to delay the gratification. You know, the marshmallow test.
Yeah, sure,
most of us eat the marshmallow. Yeah, yeah. Very few people can sit in the room with the marshmallow and just, I'm going to have that later, nicer later. Sure. So I've just been teaching myself that through like reading psychology books, you know, Atomic Habits, Psychology of Money, The Power of Compounding, all those books. But I learned by doing. Mm-hmm. So I did the copy to crypto, and then I brought it back a month ago for like the art of compounding, which is going to be a year. I'm going to put 10 euros every single day into Bitcoin, 10 euros every single day into an index fund. We'll see.
Oh, we should do something together on this, because I think there's like, I think there's very interesting things to think about around, like, going back to my point on demographics, right, and how to invest for the future. And like, people talk to me about pensions sometimes and they sort of ask me where to invest. I'm like, don't ask me that, because like, all I can tell you is a whole bunch of stuff I don't know. Yeah. But like, but when you look at sort of like how you should be investing in public markets or at all, or private markets or at all, or instead just sort of, you know, putting much more into fixed income and credit, you know, like, there's lots of interesting questions to ask around this. And like, I think it's a fascinating discussion. We should talk more about this. Because I think it's like, I often, I mean, maybe you see this as well, but like, you know, I've with like founders or, you know, existing or whatever, like a lot of the time people are kind of asking like, where do you invest? Because, you know, all people have ever done is invest in their own thing the time, or they haven't had the time to think about it. And it's like, you get a lot of people coming together and they're either trying to reinvent the wheel, or they're trying to learn everything from scratch, or they're like, where
trying to become an expert in it. You don't need to become an expert. You just need to know enough.
Yeah.
You can't be an expert in everything.
I think, look, my sort of basic outlook is try and avoid the traps, right? I mean, it's the Munger thing, right? Like, but I am kind of startled at, on average, sort of what the level of investment literacy, financial literacy.
Well, here's what I find strange. Two things I find strange. I'll give you the kicker about my experiment now in a second. One thing I find strange is that people will do nothing and then try leap to genius mode. They'll like try get outsmart the market. Very few people can do that. Probably one in a million can outsmart the market by getting really lucky. But we have this false illusion that we can outsmart the market, just even though we've no real experience in it. So I just try to do the opposite. I just try be very, very steady, very kind of like just be involved. Here's the kicker. So I said, right, anyone want to do it with me, just get involved. Again, caveat, not financial advice, caveat, don't invest. You know, all the usual shite you have to kind of cover yourself with. I said, look, if you want to get involved, I'll just create a small group. So 50 people replied, said, yeah, love to do it with you. Wrote them an email, said, right, look, it's week one, we're going to do it. I'm going to put 50 quid into Bitcoin, 70 quid into Bitcoin, 70 quid into just an index fund. And so it's 50 people. We're week four this week, right? This is week five, just started week five. How many people are still active?
Oh, I would assume, so week four.
So we've just gone into week five, and I said, right, look.
And you had 50 people originally?
50 people originally. And I said, look, I'm not going to keep writing this email because I don't know if anyone's really engaged. What I'm going to do is going to move you all into a WhatsApp group. Anyone still active, reply to me.
I would say.
How many are 5 out of 50?
I would say a third. So like, what, somewhere less than 20.
Five. I was shocked.
10%.
And these are smart people. These are people who listen. They are business owners or listen to a lot of business content. So they're engaged. I would think of the demographic. They're quite an engaged demographic because loads of people love talking about it, but very few people do it. And loads of people followed along my Coffee to Crypto, and so few people did it.
Yeah, but I mean, that's true of lots of things.
It is. Like, you know, but I just find it interesting with the finance thing that's where we are.
That's fascinating. I mean, yeah, that's a pretty remarkable drop off.
But I love that kind of stuff because, like you said, you have to be in it. Like, you can't just talk about it. You can't think about it. You have to be actually doing it to learn. Mm-hmm. So I'd never be able to uncover that data without, like...
I think people kind of underestimate the importance of having sort of accountability groups. And I think that's the thing that I've read poker players do quite a bit. I think Annie Duke has written about this.
Very good writer.
Very
good writer.
Yeah, she's
I've enjoyed
she's
her books.
Yeah. You know, where like you would go and sort of explain like why you did certain things, but in a group, you know, and it's like, hey, give me feedback on this. And I think there's you know, those sort of peer clustering can be very helpful for change.
And I've done that with entrepreneurs over the years. I did it during COVID because I felt everyone was a bit disconnected, and it's interesting to watch the dynamics of people. I do like maybe meetups for 12 people, early stage founders, and some people come every week, every month with the same problem. That's why I stopped, because I felt we were spinning our wheels. I was
right.
Because it was kind of, I was all kind of doing for due diligence, and I was doing it for the good. And I was like, if I was charging probably $2,000 a year or $10,000 a year, people would be more skin in the game. And I stopped because people come with the same problems every month, but not acting. Whereas there'd be a subset of maybe three would come with a notebook, and it'd look like this, like my notebook here. It would have scribble, scribble, scribble. It would have all the notes from what they said they were going to do, what they did, what they learned, what the outcomes were. And you'd have a subset of people who just thrive on accountability.
Yeah.
I do it with a friend of mine every month. We sit down for 2 to 3 hours every month, goes through everything. What have you done? What have I done? What do you say we're going to do? Why did you not do that? What actually did you learn? Why did you change that? And like, it's unbelievable. We're two different industries, just very similar mindsets. It's one of the best things I do every month.
Yeah,
2-3 hours, just raw honesty. So you bring me slightly back. You got out of Jolt. So I want to ask you one question. Sorry, before we go on there, this is something I'm very curious about. What did it feel like when you sold? What was your feeling the next day? You've sold, money's in the bank, whatever. What did it feel like?
In Jolt or in
Duke? Either.
I was like, what's next?
So interesting.
I love making money for other people. I am not particularly consumerist about anything. I don't like.
Is there anything you wanted to get for yourself or anything for others that you were like, yeah, now I'm gonna do this now?
No. I mean, I'm just not, it's not like I'm not a watch guy. I'm not a car guy. It's not just.
Not even a trip or anything you have your eye on or a classic rap album or anything. Like, just there's nothing you just kind of like, you just.
I buy all my stuff secondhand. Like, I'm not like, it's never been a thing for, and it's funny. I've got a couple of friends who are absurdly successful and are very into cars. And are deeply disappointed that I'm not into cars. I just shrug my shoulders and like, I'm sorry. I just, whatever, like.
I want you to feel that passion. What gets you going outside of business? What gets you going?
I like ancient history. I'm an ancient history nerd. The history of humanity. I like sort of everything almost pre-Neolithic. So everything before 5,000 BC, going back to maybe about 100,000 BC. You know, the which is sort of a relatively new area of study, which technology has opened up, which is kind of cool. So ancient DNA analysis, where people are going and doing what it sounds like, DNA analysis on skeletons. And it's now showing us essentially what the patterns of humans were, you know, over the last tens of thousands of years. So originally, this is now going to turn into an ancient history podcast, but originally our sort of thinking on how sort of humans populated the earth was what's called an out of Africa theory, where like there was kind of one wave and they populated the world. What we've now realized through archaeology, but mostly ancient DNA analysis, is that like you had multiple waves of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals and a species called Denisovans, and they were all sort of interbreeding, and they had all these different pockets around the world, and it's incredibly complex over the last 100,000 years. But we're also realizing that, like, you know, the way we're taught in school, which is a terribly, terribly basic sort of version of ancient history, which was kind of like, you know, apes and trees, caveman, and then on the moon, right?
Yeah, that's I was just going to say, and then shoo, blast forward.
And it's as a result, it's kind of created this huge bias towards like simplicity of our ancient past, where we sort of think that, okay, like, you know, people were using basic tools, therefore they couldn't do much. But when you look at everything that's now being discovered in South America and even North America, you know, and you go back to maybe, let's say, sort of 4,000 BC, 5,000 BC, even 3,000 BC. Originally, like, archaeologist estimates were like, maybe there were like a few thousand people here, and then they've been revised up to sort of tens of thousands. Now, when you look at sort of what LIDAR is uncovering, and that's kind of like a surface radar that was able to look through forests, they're realizing that sort of the peak population in South America was probably in the tens of millions. You know, and it's like we're absolutely rewriting everything that we thought was the case about our ancient history. And to me, that's really cool, because it's like it's this huge mystery that is that is changing a huge amount, that gives so, like, that is so much depth in terms of like what happened before us. And when you look at sort of the ancient monuments that exist around the world, like whether it's Newgrange or whether it's Göbekli Tepe in Turkey or whether it's anywhere in South America, like there was some incredibly sophisticated engineering that was going on. But our kind of mental model of the past is like cavemen, right?
Well, we kind of tend to like almost make them like childlike.
Yeah.
Like, what could they do?
Well, either we go childlike or we go aliens, right? And it's like, hey. Like,
are we going to go full Joe Rogan here?
Yeah. I mean, well, So all that stuff was kind of cool. And I spent a lot of time reading about it, a bit of time traveling around, going to a lot of those sites.
Okay. That's all right. Cool. Okay.
But my, like, no, look, I'm a business nerd. Like I like building things. I historically sat on a few boards and do a little bit of that now as well. I like helping people to build.
Do you back the founder or do you back the idea?
I like rap music. It will always have to be the founder and then the market. I mean, it needs to be all of those, but it is founder is first.
Okay.
And all the qualities that we've talked about, resilience, ability to not die. What is the chemistry of the founders? I think
in with them or with you?
No, with each other, with them. I think it's like, I've been in this, like, I think everyone gets into this conversation when you're trying to hire like your first senior person when you're at whatever stage. And I think everyone underestimates sort of the personality compatibility aspect of all of that. I do think that's hugely underrated in terms of trying to get that human chemistry right. And sort of just watch and observe, and like, you know, I'll meet founders from time to time. They're like, we're amazing, we're really close. So then it's like, cool, tell me your last really bad argument. And they're like, we haven't had one. I'm like, all right, well, come back when you've had that and see how it is.
Can't have tough conversations. There's going to be a lot of issues bubbling under the surface there.
Well, there mightn't even be, but it's like you've got to be able to like have sort of robust engagement and to be able to come out and know that it's okay.
Yeah.
Like it's
everything isn't a nuclear thing.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens. People sweep issues under the rug and then a small thing becomes a big thing and the whole nuclear bomb is pressed or something so minor that it.
Well, it's not, I mean, even when you face serious things, you got difference of opinions and you someone wants to do a feature or product or whatever, take money or something and the other doesn't, like, you've got to have that sort of trust framework and sort of, be able to disagree, but know that you're all still pointed in the same direction. And I think that takes time, I think I've something of a reputation of spending huge amounts of time with people on interviews when they're joining our companies. I really think there's not enough hours clocked on interviews with people, and I think with founders,
it's a weird
and things,
thing. Like, for interviews are weird in the format.
Oh, I tend to. I mean, look, there's two. I think two of the best manufacturing scenarios for lying that our civilization has invented. One is interviews, and the other is age gates on websites.
Oh yeah, are you over 18? Sure.
Yeah. Yeah,
sure.
Are you over 13? Which was part of the challenge that we were solving. It's super awesome, but like, yeah.
What's your red flags for working with people, founders, staff, investors? What are your red flags? What are the things you just will not get over?
I think when it comes to investors, it's ego and just general attitude of not wanting to be helpful but also wanting to sort of leverage their involvement with the company. And I think investing is such a long-term game that, like, you just, by definition, you have to get a lot of ego in it, you know, because you're having to talk up your own book the whole time, and it takes you 10 years to figure out whether you're actually any good as an investor. I think it's people who can't, like, who are painful to deal with when you have a disagreement, and their way of disagreeing is to go nuclear, you know. And I think when you're negotiating, I mean, it's like, hey, well, we're just going to walk out completely. It's like, it's not how you structure a thing. Like, I think it's people who don't think, I mean, yes, this is transactional, but yes, this is a partnership and we're going to be working together for some number of years. I think on the founder side, it is, I mean, people who are not pleasant to be around is an entirely obvious thing to say. I mean, I've yet to meet anyone who doesn't have a no assholes rule.
Weird. Everyone has a no assholes rule, but there's tons of assholes in the startup game.
Yeah, it is strange, isn't
it? It's strange.
But I think it's someone who is prepared. What I'm looking for are people who are prepared to invest lots of time in seeing if there is a fit. And that they're prepared to sort of scale up and scale down, saying, yes, cool, we're going to go and do the shiny presentations and talk to investors and, you know, speak at conferences and whatever. But also we're just going to roll our sleeves up and we're just going to go and, like, do the documents and, you know, hang out and, you know, drink coffee with people, and, you know, they can flex all the way up and down. I mean, I think anyone who can't do that is not sort of quite well equipped for what needs to be done. And I think there is, like, an emotional stability. It's probably an important criteria.
Don't get too high, don't get too low.
Yeah. I think all of those are probably different sides of the same coin. I mean, I think I've become much more mindful, or I've learned to become much more mindful of how people feel. Sounds like a slightly robotic thing to say, but you know, in terms of learning from others and sort of thinking more empathetically, or trying to be more empathetic about that. Yeah, it's good. It's a good question. I don't know.
What mistakes do you see startups make consistently?
Raising VC money when they shouldn't. Not understanding what VC economic model is, what kind of returns they need to produce, and therefore what value and valuation the company needs to get to, and whether their industry can support it. I think the other thing they don't consider is that their own internal opportunity cost. So when you've got money, if you've raised money from VC, and you're looking at, you know, how do you allocate that money? Like, okay, what markets are we going after? What countries are we going after? What features are we building? What customers are we serving? Like, if you're not able to generate, like, you know, at least twice your investor's rate of return on that, you shouldn't be doing it. So, like, a VC is typically trying to generate, I mean, roughly, let's say 20% IRR, so 20% return on the money per year, right? So they are trying to, in theory, kind of 3x the money for their investors, which means if they're giving you money, like, and you're investing it into something that's kind of incremental, like, that's not going to work. You know, so you need to think, like, unless you are like taking fairly aggressive swings with what you're what you're capitalized to do, like, this isn't going to work out. And like, you know, so I mean, if you don't see a way to whatever the thing is that you're doing with that money, being able to generate at least 40%, 50% revenue growth per year, it's probably not the thing you should be spending money on. Or that's not the kind of money you should have taken. You know, and I think people should go and sort. I mean, all this stuff is written everywhere at this point, right? And the Parallel book that you referenced is one of several very good ones out there, which talk about VC business models and how they work. And I think founders should be educated on it. You know, 100%. Because there's lots of different types of capital that you can go after. You know, at this point, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's that capital matching, which is the most common thing I run into that's pretty consistent.
Before we go to a rapid fire round, what are you most excited about right now? You're in your Gandalf era of wandering, collecting, observing. What are you most excited about?
I'm most excited by the lack of visibility on the future. And the reason that kind of excites me is that, like, it's going to lead to some very interesting outcomes, because you've got very, very binary views on the world. And by definition, both of those can't be right. Like, so you're going to see some very interesting winners and very interesting losers. I think, like, you know, I've never experienced this level of very smart people having very clouded views on what comes next in terms of positive, negative, who knows. Like, and I think I sort of mean that at a sort of a business and technology and digital media level, but like, you look around the world geopolitically and, like, you know, Christ. And that, on one hand, it's scary and weird, but on the other hand, it's exciting. Like, you know, I think at a macro level, that's the case. I would say on a micro level, like, I'm just gonna go back and say it's all the advancements that we're making in understanding ancient history, like. We're now, no, but it's the meeting.
I thought you were going to give me some deep personal insight there.
Oh Lord, no, I've none of that, Garrett. But the like. The intersection of technology with archaeology is, like, it's incredible. Like, there was this interesting sort of machine learning project called Vesuvius Scrolls, where they were looking at all of these scrolls that had been recovered from Pompeii, and you couldn't open them without them disintegrating.
Oh yes,
I don't know if you saw that project.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but I've seen Nat, people talking about similar things.
As an AI investor, I'm blanking on his name. Nat something, Nat Friedman, I think. And he put together this project, and like, you had some fantastic sort of ML and AI minds all going at this, starting now to be able to go and sort of decipher ancient text from rolled up scrolls. That's using wild. Scans. And like, we will obviously never invent time traveling, but like, you're getting to the point where you're able to deploy this technology in such interesting ways to understand more about where we came from. And I think that's very cool. And last thing, I don't, you're gonna have to chop this up and edit it.
We're gonna, like, go for a record length of time here. I've nearly taken you for an hour and 50 minutes. No way. So we'll do a record pod here.
I will let a lot of editing. I'm sorry to everyone listening. I'm kind of excited about whatever it is I do next.
What's that going to be? Come on, give us an exclusive. Come on, give us a reveal.
I'm not being coy. Like, I'm the. Look, I think the there's lots of, like, this next generation of founders and builders coming out who are either building from a kind of a conventional startup perspective, or, as I said earlier, like, building out of, like, Fortnite and Roblox and places like that. Like, you know, we've never seen as young a group of builders who have access to monetization and distribution as exists today. Like, when you look at sort of Gen Z, but even Gen Alpha, like 12-year-olds, we've never seen that before, right? And, you know, there is, you, as I said, you are going to see, like, an Amazon-shaped thing that's going to emerge from that, decade from now. I'm certain of it. And it'll probably come from, like, it'll start within a group in Discord, you know, and it'll be something else. And that will turn into a multi-billion dollar business.
We talk about body, business, brain here. So quickly before our quick fire round, how do you look after your body?
I started by giving up companies because it turns out that's terrible for your body.
The stress.
I started investing in my sleep maybe 4 or 5 years ago properly. I was one of those idiots that went through sort of a belief in polyphasic sleeping.
What's that?
It's essentially thinking that you could reduce the amount of sleep so that you could be more productive. So you would sleep in, like, you know, units of like 2 or 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
It is, I think, the dumbest thing I've ever done in my life. I mean, it probably shortened my lifespan by some material amount. Didn't do it for very long, but I absolutely grew up in an era of, like, oh, you just sleep less to be more productive.
Yeah.
And that is utterly idiotic.
And Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, yeah. And I read Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep.
Pretty good.
And I have become something of a sleep evangelist with people. So that started, and I do intermittent fasting. I lift heavy weights. I mean, I kind of think it's probably like Huberman 101 for a lot of stuff. But
common knowledge isn't that common. That's why I like to ask it, because, like, some of the smartest people I know have just no concept of looking after themselves. So that's why I like to try to, like, have some sort of holistic view on the whole thing, because, like, without the good body, the good brain, having a good business is kind of almost pointless.
You can. I mean, look, you're going to pour your literal life force into companies, and you have to try and balance all that stuff out. It's very hard to do. Like, I mean, but it does help, and the sleep thing is obvious, but it works. And, you know, if you can sort of boost your sort of nutritional intake, that's helpful too. I also try and just not eat bread or pasta, which are both delicious.
They are delicious.
And they're so good.
But
yeah, you know,
everything in moderation, right?
The
dose is the poison is the dose. What's that phrase?
I don't know if I've heard that. I started doing, like, maybe 2-3 years ago, I started doing blood tests twice a year. That was speaking my language. Yeah, it was a game changer. And
that's an area I would love to either start or be an investor in, longevity space. I started 2019 doing blood tests every 6 months. Mm. I've been able to reverse my biological age by 9 years.
What's your metabolic age?
32.
Oh, I'm 30.
Damn it.
Yeah. I got my bloods done like 3 weeks ago. So,
well, my goal for this year is drop into my 20s.
Ooh,
that's my
12
month goal. He's like, oh, that'll be tough, Gary. You've kind of, like, you're not maxing out.
It's very good. I mean, it's, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, but now I'm going to just have to beat you.
I mean, I don't know how accurate metabolic ages are, but, like,
if they're half right, I'll take 4.5. But do you know what? It's just more than nudges in the right direction. Mm. It's more so, because now I'm thinking about it. All right, okay, I've gone on a whole journey, longevity journey for the last 5 years. That's been a core part of it, the blood, because I think our future generation look back and go, you're just walking around like a lunatic. Mm. You didn't know what was going on in your body. How many stories have you heard? Oh, he was walking around, he was really healthy, and geez, he just dropped dead. Or, oh my God, if they caught it earlier. That will never happen to me. Mm-hmm. I'm passionate about, like, and I get my blood done every month if it's more accessible and easy. Mm. I'd have no problem going and go, quick blood test. Okay, cool.
Well, you can oversample too, but, like,
you can, but I think that the trend has to be there. Like, the data I've got now over the last, like, 5-6 years is huge. Mm. And now I'm able to see trends, I'm able to tweak and modify, and it's incredibly passionate. And then your brain, how do you look after that?
I think that's sleep. You know, I mean, again, I sort of wire that in there. I mean, I find exercise is the thing that, like, is very good for my brain, and there's absolutely been a correlation between sleep and sort of general mental health. Mm. I think, like, you know, I spent the last 10 years traveling an absurd amount. I mean, I would probably do 250,000 miles a year, and travelers, you know, going out and meeting customers and being face to face, like, it matters, and it changes things. But jet lag just is a killer. And, you know, it's that's if there was a way to avoid jet lag, that would be awesome, but there simply isn't. So you've just got to mind your sleep.
I think less. I think like hybrid and remote is good, but like nothing beats the in-person thing. But I think like once a quarter, I'm just kind of trying to think of a cadence of good travel. It's probably once a quarter, I think.
That's what I ended up sort of, but I mean, it depends on the situations that you're in. But
yeah, of course. Like different horses for courses. Right. We'll finally get to the quickfire round. Might even have to make this. Although I said yesterday to someone, I was like, you know what? I'm really going to start do a few really long ones. So there you go. I talked into existence.
Well, hold on. Let me just actually see what you asked me some very specific things.
I did, but no better man to do it. So,
yeah.
When you're in your own time, what book would you recommend every founder should read?
Well, I actually keep a list of 17 books for founders.
Unreal. Okay, I'll put it in the show notes. give me that.
I'll send you links. It's on my Goodreads page. But I would say, well, I'm actually going to give you two rather than one. I would say almost anything by Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow,
okay,
is very good. And then I would also recommend a book by his occasional research partner, Robert Cialdini, called Persuasion. Do you have it?
Persuasion. I haven't. Influence is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's amazing. This was a sequel.
Persuasion.
Very good.
Cialdini. I actually didn't know they collaborated.
Yeah, they did. They did one paper, I think.
Okay. What is something you'd learn the hard way?
When you're building a company, you are always equidistant from success and failure, no matter how good you might be feeling. You know, until you have got money in the bank and the company's been acquired and it's the money's been wired to all the shareholders, like, you are equidistant between success and failure. I mean, I once, like, tiny ramble, like, we had a one of our companies was being acquired, and the long form had been done, it was waiting signature, we had draft press releases ready to go, it's a public company, and there was one customer reference call to do because it was a big customer. CEO of the acquiring company called the CMO of the big customer, it's big company. It should have been just routine 5-minute, you guys good? Cool, great, fine, done. Somehow that whole thing got wildly out of control, went absolutely sideways. Someone said something weird, the other person reacted weird, the deal fell apart. I had to call, I was on the board of this company, I had to call the founders who are sitting at a pool waiting to open champagne to tell them the deal had fallen apart.
No.
And they actually couldn't believe me. I understand. We put it back together. It took us 18 months to do.
Oh my God.
But like, it was the most unbelievable thing I've ever seen. And I'm sure people have lots of stories like that. So you never know.
Good lesson though. Literally don't count the champers until it's popped. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Inner calm. Relationships, friends, ability to relate to people. I'm sure just all the usual stuff that founders have to go through.
Do you think they have to?
I think when you are building a company, you, as I said, you are pouring your life force into it. It doesn't come for free. Like, I think it's very tough being the partner of a founder. I think it's one of the reasons that, like, I've been lucky to have such amazing co-founders over the years. Like, you know, but you know, if you're a partner of a founder of someone or some people who are building a company, they have to put the company first. Very difficult to juggle that. Very difficult.
To even say that out loud is difficult.
Hopefully, you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests in this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So why not today? If you want a startup or or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
I would split it into 100 checks of 100 grand and I would go and find 100 very interesting builders in Discord, Roblox and Fortnite, and I would invest across all of them.
Very specific. They're the perfect kind of questions I like answered. Specific, tangible, real. Now, a variation on the theme. I'm going to give you 1 million, but it's for one person or one company to invest in. Who is it?
Two answers, big and small.
Go on.
This is breaking it.
No founder answers this question straight. I think it's definition of the founder. Well, no, find
actually,
a way.
No, you should ask better questions because you should define what kind of return you want.
Okay.
Because right. Like when you say you give me 10 million, it's like, well, what do you want back? Do you want yield? Okay. Do you want me to turn that 10 into 20 or 10 into 100?
Okay.
What's the level of risk you're willing to take?
Very interesting. No one's fed that back to me.
Because I'm like, I can give you very different answers.
Okay.
So, okay, let me give you the, on the 1 million question. So if you want to convert your 1 million into 5 million, I would say there's a very interesting software company in Italy called Bending Spoons. And they are buying up a lot of tier two apps and pieces of software. So they were the ones who bought Evernote. And they're basically going in, retooling the whole thing, changing pricing, firing everyone. They are basically what the future of private equity is going to look like, which is software. So if you think about private equity buys like a lot of like, you know, mom and pop type business, things like that. Well, if you think about what the future that's going to be, it's going to be people running sort of apps and people running, you know, pieces of software like that. So they're doing that. So you give 1 million to them, you get 5 million back. That's my sort of private equity style answer. If you want a venture style answer to the 1 million, I would look at what Sean Blanchfield's new AI startup is, which is called Gentic. And that is my, how do you turn 1 million into 100 million? I would go there.
Wow. Two cracking answers. Brilliant. If you were starting from zero again in 2024, what would you build?
Something focused on old people and cybersecurity. That is, again, like I look for growth markets. Hmm. What is something I can look at and go, that's going to be 10 times bigger or 50 times bigger in 10 years time. And I think digital crime around fraud, around identity theft, and not just for old people, I think that's going to come down.
Yeah.
As we
talk. We all get older.
No, but
so
also
we all drop in that bucket.
No, but also, but I think we're actually getting older quicker. Like when you see sort of like 20-year-olds and how they will run around us who are still very much digital natives, things like TikTok. Mm. Right. And it's, you know, as I said, I think it's interesting that you are seeing the second highest rate of digital fraud in the US happening within 30-year-olds. I think they've gotten a bit complacent.
It's an interesting one. I must look into it. My theory would be that they're trying to gamble on things that might be too good to be true. That would be my theory.
But I think they're still being naive about then, like, what that is, because this is fraud, right? So I mean, it's not, hey, I did a stupid thing and I put money into a coin. This is like someone stole my credentials or whatever, right? So yes, I think it's linked to all of that, but I mean, you know, it's still sort of a level of naivety about a thing, right?
Yeah, there's so much data. We've so much data, and we produce so much data every day that it's difficult. What do you believe that other people would find strange or strongly disagree with?
I am always quite skeptical about second-time founders.
Say a little bit more.
I think founders often learn very little from success. And I think, and I include myself in this, you go into your second venture thinking you know a hell of a lot more than you actually do, or thinking you've learned a lot more than you actually do. And I think there is a lot of incorrectly directed confidence that goes into second-time founders. Third-time founders, I'm very interested in.
It's your next fund, third-time founder fund.
3TF.
Worst ideas. What's been your worst investment?
Polyphasic sleeping. Close second was Irish Property in 2007.
Two very unique and good answers. Yeah, Irish Property 2007. We've all been there. Don't feel alone. What's been your best investment?
Spending excessive amounts of money on flying to places to meet people in person. And it's an argument I've often gotten into with people about, do you need to go to a place? Could you not maybe just call them? But I have found time and time and time and time again, this is also not a surprising statement, that like you go and you physically hang out with people and you build some chemistry and it works. And okay, like it means flying to wherever, North Carolina or Buenos Aires or Sydney or whatever it is, but it is worth doing. It's hard, it's painful, it's not brilliantly scalable, it still absolutely works. I will continue to do it.
I'm 1000% agreement. This is a very different conversation if we're on Zoom.
Oh,
we're not doing 2 hours, we're not sitting here, we're not getting really to know each other very well, we can have side tangents. I am 1000% in agreement, and that's why I'm going to travel so much next year. What's your final piece of advice to every founder listening?
Assume that anyone you're asking advice from is mostly just talking survivorship bias. Like, so much of this game is that. And I mean that on both founder and investor side. Like, it's when you're building a company, like, so much of it is situationally and it is situationally dependent. Like, it is temporally dependent on what's going on. And, you know, that's why I really, when people ask me what advice, I really hate giving advice. I sort of say, here were my experiences. Here's the shit we did wrong. Here's what we did, and I think it might have been good. But like, you know, I see too many people who sort of like listen to advice and take it literally and run back into their companies going, well, these two companies had successful outcomes and they sort of created an org structure that looked like this.
Therefore, if X, then Y. Yeah. And context is everything.
It's not even context. It's outcomes. Successful outcomes depend on so few things. You can do an awful lot of things that have an incremental impact, but it's only incremental. You know, and I think humans in general are pretty bad at distinguishing between innovation and novelty, because they kind of both look the same at a certain range.
We didn't even get to touch on your writing. Where can people learn a little bit more about you and your writing? Because it is super. I have to give a massive shout out to that. Go and read your writing, because it is, if you enjoyed this long, if you've made it to 2 hours, you are going to bloody, you're going to bloody love his writing. So where can people learn a little bit more about you and follow some of your stuff that you're working on?
Well, I'm on X or Twitter, whatever. But I write a newsletter. You can get it at dylancollins.com. Or there's like a LinkedIn version, which is like weirdly 10 times popular. Which says a lot about LinkedIn.
Power distribution.
More so than my writing. It is the power distribution. Yeah. But yeah, I sort of, it's a nice outlet for me.
Dylan, thank you so much for joining us on this epic episode.
Gary, thank you. And also apologies that it was so long, but it was very enjoyable.
I just kept you going. I'd keep here for a 4 hour one if we could. We could have done one of those 8 hour.
We're getting into Lex Friedman territory with that, right?
Dylan, you're a gent. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gary.